אני החלטתי לעבור לאנגלית הערב בגלל כל המורים האלה כל הזמן מדברים על רכות ושמחה ונינוחות ואז למה לא? I enjoy myself, so I'm going to switch to English. אבל גם לשם שינוי. And because of Mark. So the talk tonight is really on vipassana from a certain perspective. I want to take firstly a traditional perspective that is a little bit to help you understand where all this comes from and why we do things the way we do here. And so that it's not just something that one day Stephen, Simi, Jonathan and Adelia sort of got together and decided, wow, let's do this and let's do that and let's do this to them and let's do that to them. So I'll give you some background and then a little bit on the meaning of Vipassana in terms of our practice together. So, if you just, in a way, put your mind back 2,500 years to a bunch of sadhus wandering around North India with a respected teacher called Gautama, the Buddha, and really incredibly radical group. They insisted on abandoning everything. They had no possessions. They had no home. They didn't eat anything unless it was freely given to them. They regarded the household life, which is all our life, namely the ordinary village life, as a dusty, in their words of the text, dusty, full of worries, busy, and thoroughly difficult. And they said, "You can find another way. Get out of all that." And the basic instruction was just sit under a tree and watch the reality inside you and outside you. And it's very radical because it wasn't at the time they were the great religion of Brahmanistic Hinduism, following the gods. And the Buddha said, you know, forget the gods. It's as if someone today came to you and said, as Jews, or came to us as Jews and said, forget the respect for Moshe Rabbeinu. Be Moshe. Be him. Go up the mountain, stay there 40 days, meditate in silence, and see God. Or at least, in the case of Moshe, the back of God. Actually, it's a bit like us seeing the back of thoughts. I came today and decided that that's a very good image, that really all we can see is things that just fly past. So we're always seeing the back of God. We're never seeing the front of God. So it's a nice image. But anyway, it's very radical. And in his teaching, he gave around, traditionally, 80,000 different forms of practice. And the reason is that there were so many different kinds of people who sat in front of him and said, give me teaching. So for each one, he gave a different kind of practice. Similar but different. And there was in it no belief. In one of his talks he said, don't believe in things just because lots of people say them, just because they're written in the books, just because you feel you ought to, or just because pressure, or just don't believe in things because they simply cloud your power of clear seeing. Because the only thing you need to bring you, in a way, to the transcendental world is just to see life as it really is. You don't need to believe in anything. You don't need to believe in Olam Haba, another world. You don't need to have the gods to help you. You don't need anything. You have the power yourself. And that's why it's very radical. In this life, to be totally, totally free and in the world of divinity, Elohut, living there. So it's a very radical teaching. And it gave rise, as all radical teachings do, in the end to a great religion full of rules and golden Buddhas and millions of people worshipping gods and so on. And, you know, history does that. And just like, I think, in every religion you'll find the essence, which is pure spirituality, and then time brings layers and layers, a bit like us as human beings. Time brings layers and layers and layers of stuff, and we forgot the purity of the baby Buddha inside us. Same with the, with all of this. So the religion of Buddhism arose over thousands of years with all its unnecessary systems of control that is in every religion. Only in the last 50 years, in a way, has there been a revolution, and one of the revolutions that happened to Buddhism is its arrival in the Western world. And every time this kind of change happens, it brings a great renewal. And there really is a great renewal. And the renewal began basically in Burma in the 50s. And at that time, remember, Burma was under the British rule. And the British and the Western world generally is a Protestant world. And the Protestants are not very happy, ever since Luther, are not very happy with just those things about religion that the Buddhists were busy with. Ritual, golden Buddhas, priesthood, the hierarchy of the monks in control, the householders down there somewhere, the monks, you know, up here, and so on. And the British, in a way, influenced Burma to think again about the power of the individual, the one human being, for his own liberation, out of the priesthood. Plus some prophecies, that there were traditional prophecies that 2,500 years after the Buddha, there would be a renewal. This is traditional in Burmese Buddhism, and it happens to be in the 50s, 1950 or so. So at that time, something very radical happened in Burma, which is that monks, for the first time, went out to the community and began to teach to lay people again. And this really didn't happen before. Before that, the lay community, meaning the householders, the ordinary family people, their relationship with Buddhism was about generosity, was about prayers, was about, again, afterlife, Olam Haba, this kind of thing, and the holding the monks as a kind of sacred community, that was their duty. So the monks came out, began to teach meditation practices, that is spiritual practice, to the community, began in Burma. And we benefit from that now, because it, and in the 50s there was no real practical Buddhism in the West. There was lots of books, translations, academics translating Pali text into German. In the end of the last century it was German, and then gradually into English, Anyway, you couldn't read them. Even the translations were impossible, unreadable, and certainly not practical. Practical text in the way they were written. But this revolution in Burma, a little bit in Thailand, and then after that, the Tibetans being going out of Tibet, and Tibetan practice Mahayana Buddhism coming out also from the closed community of Tibet, coming into India and then into the West, that created a big movement of renewal of spirituality. That means the core essence of Buddhism, namely spiritual practice, is the core essence arriving in the West. A lot of it without all of these golden Buddhas and the religion of Buddhism. Well, you can find it in the West, but this renewal is very important. And because of this renewal, really up to now we didn't talk about Buddhism at all. And the whole, doesn't matter if you never heard the word Buddhism, you'd be better off actually. But to give respect to the Buddha, I'm giving this language now. But you can pass through a 10-day or 5-day or 1 month a retreat and purify the mind, just like the early Buddhists. They didn't talk about Buddhism. They just they sat down and purified their being. Same with us. So we're doing something which is similar to the early Buddhist. And we don't need anything about Buddhism in order to do that. So this is the renewal, which I think has very, very far-reaching importance. I personally think it's one of the greatest things that has happened to the Western world in the last half century. And that's my own opinion. But I believe from there, our children will see a radically different world. Maybe not us, but anyway. So the question is now, when we ask what kind of teaching from the Buddha we apply into the Western world, and how this retreat is built, and where is our authority to teach this, from where do we get the right teaching, from where do we find it? And that's a very difficult question. In the 80,000 different forms of meditation, which one does Simi get up in the morning and give instructions on? To everybody, not to each of you separately, but to 100 people. And this is a major question. We discussed it last night, the teachers together. We discussed it quite a lot. What form is right? Because it's all new. We are recreating something here. We are reconstituting something. How do we know we're doing the right thing? So it's maybe you didn't think about it, but it's a major issue. So it might give you less confidence or more confidence. I don't know. but there has been a lot. But fortunately, there is some background to this. We do take some help from forms that were developed over the last 50 years. For example, in Burma, the form developed by the teachers of Ubakin, who's a teacher of Goenka. There's a teacher called I think his name is his name is Sayatet, and he decided to do 10-day courses of the kind that Goenka teaches as the student of Ubakin, who is a student of Sayatet. But I mean, we are still reinventing something. And there's an interesting example, because people going to Goenka courses, and I've done many courses with Goenka, there the 10 days is regarded as an absolute essential and almost holy number of days. And if you say, we do 7-day courses in Tovana, they say, no, second rate, sukbet. But how did the 10 days happen? Sayatet was going out to the community, and he was teaching. He was teaching. I don't know how it worked with a lay person who had plantations, and this plantation owner taught his workers. Now his workers only had 10 days holiday, so he made the package of 10 days to fit the holiday time of the workers in the plantation. That's the way things happen. And so there is a combination of things here, which is both tradition and invention or creation of new forms, trying to be true to the deepest spiritual tradition of the Buddha. That's our challenge. Not to take on board unnecessary things, not to take on board the religion and the belief, trying to be as authentic as possible to the original teaching of the Buddha, which is very pure. Remember that 10,000 texts, I happen to have one here, I want to talk about it in a minute. 10,000 texts, the suttas of the Buddha, are all instructions on spirituality. They're all different forms of instruction. They're instructional texts. They're not like the Torah, which is journal, has a lot of wisdom in it, but is also a journal of a people, is also a story of events, it's also gods and so on. So this is instruction. So we're trying to, in a way, go back to that. And the form is based on that. Silence that we use here is a form based on original teaching, where silence is given as a virtue. It's not an absolute essential. It's a virtue. It's something that's helpful to practice, so we bring it into the retreat. The simplicity of sitting down and watching the truth as it arises, we bring it into the retreat. Some basic elements which are fundamental. And it's not easy. For example, the fundamental teachings, as you heard from Yonatan, the Four Noble Truths, a lot of it are about non-attachment, not holding on, letting things come and go, finding places where we're stuck and holding on, and letting them go, or letting them melt, letting them dissolve. That's the process. Now, if we had a very strict form, we're against that process. The process is liberation, not holding forms like strict rules and so on. You have to do this and you have to do that and have to do this and have to do that. Control, and then you end up believing that if I don't do these rules, I will never reach the heaven. If I don't do this, I will never get there. That's the obvious thing. If we have control, you have dependence on form. On the other hand, if we have no form, so it's just like weekend in the beach in Eilat, everyone having a good time, eating a lot, resting a lot, arguing about politics, etc. Just there'd be nothing here. So we have to have a middle way, which is a way which is very traditional. Finding a balance, finding the wise way. And the way we do it here in Tovana, we have a lot of influence from the Thai forest tradition and teachers that have come from there, which are not as strict as the Burmese, but still dedicated, still have some form, still have some process going on, still have steadiness, asking you to be determined, to come on time, to sit for 3/4 of an hour, to sit up and have some energy, etc., etc., but yet not too strict and requiring too many rules and too much discipline, because if we feel in our view the middle way, this middle way is right, and it's very traditional. The Buddha himself, after many years of incredible strict discipline, his enlightenment came when he relaxed, just relaxed. Many stories. I think that in our case, we're always finding the middle way. It's not easy to find, but the middle way, one middle way between form and formlessness, another middle way is between pushing and relaxing, another middle way, there's many of them. But we're trying to find the wise middle way of balance, the Spielzahav, in the form that we're using here. Not too much control, not too much freedom, not too much pushing, but not too much relaxing, not too much not too much pain, and not too much indulgence, somewhere in the middle way. So the form, to go a little bit closer now to the form that we do use here, we start with several days of practice on the breath. And the reason is to develop some powers of attention, some powers of steadiness of mind. And we do this by watching the breath and the body, especially the breath. And so we start with really sharpening the tools of attention. And especially because our mind is usually very scattered, very, very spread, mufuzar, very scattered all over the place, full of stuff, full of disturbance, full of issues. So before we can really begin to work on this process of cleaning, of purifying, of discovering who we are, so the first few days are days of developing tools of attention, tools of concentration. So we talked about mindfulness, that is the power of mind to see the reality, to be in touch with reality, and not somewhere else, but right here. And we talked a little bit about concentration or steadiness, samadhi, meditative concentration. And this was the first few days. And this is the way it's built. After the first few days, this power of samadhi or attention begins to shake the ground underneath us. And it should. It begins to bring stuff up. Itself, just if we sit watching the breath, stuff comes up. And we think, oh, I'm so much stuff inside me, my thoughts are going crazy, I've got all this pain and emotional stuff coming up, and so on and so on. And we think there's something about us that's no good sometimes. But the truth is, we are, by the samadhi, by the attention, by the concentration, and by the quietness, we're actually beginning to peel the reality inside us, to peel it, to open it, to allow, give space to things to come up. So it's very much part of the process to take the first few days in order to, in a way, sharpen the tools, and the next few days to actually work with what comes up. And this is samadhi or mindfulness, and vipassana, which is seeing content and working with content, which I'll explain a little bit in a minute. It's indeed not exact. So we do, it's not as if we do it very, very precisely, 3 days exactly, and then we suddenly have a big ceremony and so on, and we say, now vipassana. It's rather mixed. But still, there is a kind of movement there. At the beginning, working with the tools, and then afterwards using the tools. We still work with them, we still work with the breath, we still work with attention, but we're using the tools to purify our mind, to let stuff go, to let stuff come up and disappear, to take off layers of conditioning that are oppressing us, that are heavy on us. Begin to see what's underneath. The authority that we use for this is one of the mainly is one of the texts called the Satipatthana Sutta. And at the beginning of this text, it does say a very good place to start all of this is the breath. Breathing in, I see, I observe, I know. Breathing out, I'm becoming calmer, I'm becoming relaxed. Breathing in, I feel present. Breathing out, I let go stuff. Breathing in, breathing out. Breathing in, breathing out. Sitting, seeing the breath and the body inside and outside. Bringing the attention to my life. It's just, that's the way the sutta begins. But it then continues and it says, okay, apply this to the body. And that's exactly what we did. We started with the body. Apply it to the body, because the body is a ground. The body is a good safe place. It's kind of a good anchor, because they're organ. It's a good place to begin this work. Reliable, steady, it's here. It's not abstract. It doesn't get us lost too quickly. And then, when we after we begin to apply to the body, feelings. How are we with feelings? I like something, I don't like something, I feel hot, I feel cold, I like the food, I don't like the food, I have resistance to this, I have some anger to this, I don't have anger, I have love, I have joy, I have to begin to use the same tools that we use for the breath as with the feelings, with liking, with not liking, and moving on. Same tools for the breath, emotional life, mental life. Begin to look at my thoughts just like I look at the breath. Look at the emotions and feelings just like we look at the breath. And continuing, looking at consciousness itself. That is the mind looking at the mind. What's happening in the mind? What's the mind itself like? What's the nature of mind? What's the nature of the qualities in me? How am I? My energies, my quality of love, quality of presence, quality of openness, quality of generosity, these sort of higher qualities. Look at them. How much? Are they there? Are they not there? When are they there? So, in the end, the sutta really covers all stages of the human being and says everything is open to observation. Everything is material, is raw material for the eye, for the inner eye of mindfulness, and we can go through the whole of the human experience this way. But then, how does it help us? What is vipassana? So vipassana means to see clearly. It means to see things as they really are. And most of the task we have to do, most of the work that we have to do is just that, is not more than that. It's just seeing things the way they really are. It's interesting that there is, in the tradition, there is a kind of a demon figure called Mara. And the demon figure is a kind of a representative of, you could say in the our tradition, Sitra Acha, the other side. The devil, or means the things that bring us down, that hold us down, that the desires and the angers and so on. So it's a personification. Mara comes, and especially to the monks, they're sitting and Mara comes and tempts them, or Mara comes and teases them, or Mara comes and confuses them. Really, all the stuff that we have, confusion, anger and so on, it's Mara coming to us. And every time Mara comes, the Buddha or the monks didn't fight him, didn't destroy him, didn't get angry with him, They just saw him. That's all they needed to do, is see him. And every time the same words appear. And Mara, once seen, he creeps away. He can't be there when he's seen. He just creeps away. He slides away, disappears, comes back. So it's up to us to basically be, the job that we have to do here is to simply be what you might call in English a fair witness. A fair witness, meaning ed, not just ed, aid a witness, but a witness without interessing, without bias, without
Lolo masopanim.
Masor panim?
Make me feel good. I'm sure that half of the people here are not exactly sure of the meaning of this.
Okay. Good. So we're in it together. Yeah, we're in it together. That's fair enough. So anyway, we need to be a balanced witness. Right? We just need to be a fair witness to what is coming up. That's not so easy. And many of you experience at these times emotions. And emotions are an example of something which it's very difficult to be a fair witness with. And only for one reason. They have so much power. They are very powerful. Our anger, our fear, anxiety, they have a lot of strength and power over us. So our powers of awareness, of watching, which we're developing through the breath, may not be enough to really be able to contain the emotion and be a fair witness. That means to sit quietly in our place with a balanced mind, with a steady view, and say, right, here is anger. Here is anger. Where? It's here. What thoughts are coming with it? Memories of what happened before. What's happening in the heart? It's painful. What's my mood? Not good. What's going on the body? A lot of heat. That's it. That's it. That's being fair witness to anger. If we can be fair witness to anger, the anger basically doesn't exist anymore. It's Mara who said, oh, you see me? Okay. He doesn't exist. He has turned into sensations in the body, contraction in the stomach, pumping of the blood, thoughts in the mind. Where is anger? So that's the power of observation, of being witness, and we don't need to do that much more, because when we see these things, by their very nature, they come and they go. They don't last. They move. They change. And so we're just witnessing a river that never stays the same. And so it's, where's the anger? It's turned into a river. It's just turned into stuff that passes by. Where's the pain in the shoulder? It's just a river. It's turned into all kinds of sensations and movements and so on, and it goes away. Especially when I ring the bell. Where's the pain in the back? Gone. Gone. So there's actually not a lot we need to do here. It may seem that we're working very hard, but there isn't a lot that we need to do. We need to sit here and be a fair witness. And not to expect too much, not to expect that problems will be solved, not to expect that things will appear or not appear. Just be fair witness. When something appears to us, thank you. If something doesn't appear, thank you. Just be fair witness. Why? Because this way, by being a kind of container for our life, it appears without manipulation. It begins to appear layer after layer. And it's exactly that process of things appearing layer after layer that allows us to find a bigger space in which we can be. Because when something goes, I mean, I don't know if you've asked yourself this, anger comes up, we see it and it vanishes. So what takes its place? What's there then? To sustain the anger is a lot of energy. To sustain emotion, fear, is a lot of energy. Just, you know that. We're thinking like crazy all the time. And thoughts going round and round and round. If this layers of our conditioning, hatnaya, if it comes and it goes, it opens a space. And in this space, we find ourselves in a bigger and more joyful and more free space. These things, this conditioning, takes a lot of room and takes a lot of effort and takes a lot of energy. When our life before us, our conditioning, the layers and layers of our history come up and just dissolve and change and move, it opens another space for us. In their place, there is spirituality. What is spirituality? In the traditional formula, it's the understanding of dukkha, anicca, anatta. That means dukkha, meaning understanding the sources and the nature of isipuk, not satisfying. Something about life is difficult. Understanding the nature, not just suffering it, but feeling it as a teacher. That the understanding of dukkha is a deep understanding of the nature of existence. That to be born is a story. It's difficult. It's not a joke. It's not a problem either. But it's just difficult. And the nature of this is in existence itself, in our relationship with existence. As we are born into it, we cry. So it's understanding that, not as a problem, but as a teacher. And as Yonatan said the other night, anicca is understanding the way things flow and change and are naturally free. Everything is naturally free. Understanding that we ourselves flow and change. We're made of millions of molecules, cells, processes, fluids, thoughts. Everything is moving all the time. Nothing stays in one place. And it's freeing us. And the third, anatta, is just simply that we are bigger than this self. That no thing is really just a thing in itself, including us. That we are bigger than this Stephen, this Ophir. Just, we're not locked in to a self. And those kind of experiences, these kind of experiences again and again, is the process of vipassana. And they lead us to a deep understanding, panya. They lead us to liberation. They lead us to living in a bigger and freer space. So the process is letting the experiences that come up, letting them come, be a witness, then letting them go. In other words, things liberate themselves. We actually don't need to do that much. liberation, freedom is there already. And we just let things liberate themselves, free themselves. We just let things come up and vanish. There's a nice quote from William Blake about this. And sometimes people say, okay, what about... I understand that I want the pain and difficulty to come up and disappear, but the joy? Should that come up and go as well? Surely I want the joy, but I don't want the pain. But William Blake has a very nice quotation. He says, if you kiss the joy as it flies, you live in eternity's sunrise. In other words, if you kiss the joy as it flies, let the joy also fly, and just kiss it as it passes by. And there's something in this letting go which is eternal. If we hold on to the joy, we're still stuck. But even the joy comes and we kiss it as it passes by. So everything we let go, that's the second noble truth, is let things, see the nature, in the nature of things, they are not stuck. We don't need to hold on to anything at all. Because every time we let go, we let the fist open, we don't grasp anything. Every time we find ourselves in a bigger space. Every time we let stuff go, we live in a bigger space. The process is like digging a well. When we dig a well for water, the only thing we need to do is throw away everything that's not water. So we do. We don't actually busy with water. We just throw away the stuff that's not water. And eventually water is there. So the same way, things come up, the angers, the this, the difficulties, the thoughts, the reactions. Things come up, we throw. We don't need to look for the water. The water will be there. We just throw away everything that's not water. And to finish, I'd like to talk about this text, which is called The Log. And this gives a sense of where we're heading. And it starts, on one occasion, the Blessed One, the Buddha, was staying at a certain place on the bank of the river Ganges. He saw a large log being carried along by the current near the bank of the river Ganges.
What's a log?
A log is a bull etz. Actually, he's very lucky because I spent 2 years on the banks of the river Ganges. I never saw one log. I saw about 5,000 dead buffaloes. I saw about 200 dead bodies. I saw a few dolphins, indeed. It's very beautiful, yeah. I saw a few dolphins. I saw a lot of shit. So he was lucky. I think the Ganges was a lot cleaner at that time. And he said to the monks, "Monks, do you see that large log being carried along by the current of the river Ganges?" And he said, "Yes, Lord." And he said, "Monks, if that log doesn't get stuck at one shore, and doesn't get stuck on the other shore, and doesn't sink down in the middle, and doesn't get washed up on an island, and doesn't get taken by humans, and doesn't get rotten, it will just by itself arrive in the ocean. It will go to the ocean. Why is this? Because the current of the river Ganges tends towards the ocean. It inclines, it moves towards the ocean." And basically what he said was, getting stuck on one bank of the river means getting stuck on the senses, on what I want and what I like and what I need. Getting stuck on the other side of the river was getting stuck in the world, the world is like this, the world is like that, it should be, I should do this, I should do that. Getting stuck with human beings means busy with a household life, I need to earn money, I need to have a job, I'm sorry, I can't meditate, I don't have time. Getting rotten inside means morality, just having ethical principles. If you don't get stuck on this bank of I want, I don't want, on the other bank of being in the world and so on, not stuck on me, what I need, and the world, what it needs, but free, you don't have to do anything, because by itself the awareness will carry you towards the ocean. Just don't get stuck and the log keeps going. You don't have to do so much. And the vision of the Dharma, this beautiful vision that each one of us in our life, if we just stay unstuck one way or another, we just keep going, but don't get stuck. Don't get stuck anywhere. Just drop things. Just let things come up and let them go. Just drop this and drop that. Keep going with our awareness. Keep going with our intention to true spirituality. We'll get to the ocean. It will carry us. We don't need to do so much. We don't need to push so much. It's there waiting for us. It's already inside us, actually, the ocean. We just don't need to worry about it too much. But just don't get stuck on this bank of the river or the other. Okay, thank you.